For the record, my name is Vern Rieke, R-I-E-K-E. I teach at the law school, University of Washington. I practiced law briefly, private practice for a time, and then I went into academic law, and I've been there since. This is a discussion tonight about the relationship between parents and children. And I've hung a subtitle on it, Do Children Have Rights? And it's necessary, I think, to understand that term rights, or else we won't be talking to each other at all. When someone regarding a legal problem says a right, it is necessary to find that some other correlative duty exists. Because I don't have a right in the abstract. If I have a right, that means that somebody owes me something. So a right and a duty always have to be found as a pair. If there's no right, there's no duty. If there's no duty, there's no right. Now, rights come in various kinds, and we talked a little bit about this last night. There are so-called constitutional rights. We start out with our Declaration of Independence by saying that we believe that our Creator endowed us with certain unalienable rights. And if you've ever stumbled over that unalienable rights, the word alienate means to dispossess oneself of it. If you own a farm and you alienate it, it means that you transfer it to somebody else, you sell it. Now, what the Declaration of Independence was saying is that there are certain characteristics of human beings that are so basic that there is no way that you can dispossess yourself of those characteristics and still be a human being. It doesn't mean that these characteristics cannot be taken away from you. Of course they can be taken away from you, not legally, not constitutionally perhaps, unless it's by something called due process of law. But if you are dispossessed of those things, then in many ways you simply are no longer a human being of the kind that we like to think God created. Think about those three things for just a moment. In the Declaration of Independence, we say that God endowed us with life. Well, that one's pretty simple. If your life is taken away from you, you're no longer a living human being on this world. With liberty, that's an awfully big word for our discussion tonight, liberty. And in the Declaration of Independence, it says, with the pursuit of happiness. Now, that one didn't make it over to the Constitution. The Constitution talks about life and liberty and property. And the reason for this is that there's no way that I know of that law can guarantee that you're going to be happy. The French, incidentally, had precisely the same experience in their revolution, which was a little after ours, as you recall. They talked about equality, liberty, and fraternity. Equality, liberty, and brotherhood. When they got around to writing their constitution, their fourth draft, the one they finally adopted, they talked about life and equal protection of the laws and the ownership of property. Brotherhood never made it. Same reasons. I mention this because sometimes we can talk about what people think of, I believe, as human rights. And human rights may very well mean things which cannot be claimed and implemented and obtained by any legal process. If one has a right which is described as being a human right, it may mean a right which cannot be obtained by a court or by a police force or by an army, and that the duty that's owing is not one which is enforceable by some sort of violent conduct, and by violence I mean a policeman or a marshal or a sheriff or an army or the militia or the home guard or something of that sort, But the correlative duty to a human right is one that we owe because we feel obligated to persons as a servant of mankind, a sense of decency. I think it's the kind of Christian constraint that we feel to share, and so forth. I'm not talking about those rights tonight. I'm going to talk about constitutionally protected rights, about rights which arise out of legislation of some sort, Congress, state legislature, city council, county commissioners. Somebody else has got the right to make rules which are constitutionally enforceable, may confer rights upon people. That's because somebody else has a duty. Or there are some rights which we think of as arising, some people would say, natural rights or natural law. Another way of saying that, at least in part, is to say common law or traditional law or the sense of our culture. And I've spent a long time talking about that last night, and if you were here then, why, you now know more about it than I do, and if you weren't, why, I can't do much more with it anyway. So take my word for it that there is such thing as case law, decisional law, common law, cultural law, which is law as what is sometimes called ethical behavior or perhaps morality, although I am not clear where the lines of demarcation come in those continuums from one kind of right to another. Now, I must say a couple words about, a couple paragraphs, I'm afraid, about constitutional rights, because we didn't even touch them last night, at least I don't recall that we did. The ones that are most significant in the relationship between a parent and a child arise out of the Fifth Amendment to the Federal Constitution, part of the Bill of Rights. You know, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution of the United States were adopted at the same time the Constitution was. They came in as a separate package, but they were at the same time. It was called the Bill of Rights, and they described certain things. You know, they can't quarter soldiers in your house without your permission, and you have a right to speak freely and to worship according to your own convictions, First Amendment kinds of rights, and so forth. Well, in the Fifth Amendment, it says that the federal government may not enact laws which deprive you of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Now, please notice that the without due process of law is in there. If you are given the process to which you are entitled, I didn't make that up. The United States Supreme Court said due process is not given when a person does not receive the process which is his due. Like that. That's it. And so if you don't get the process which you are due, you've been deprived of due process. That means you're entitled to certain things like notice that there's going to be a hearing and that somebody's going to try and convict you of something or take something away. You're entitled to be there. You're entitled to make your case. You're entitled to the rules of evidence. You're entitled to the normal rules of trial. In other words, you're entitled to what we might call fair hearing, your day in court. That's called procedural due process. You're entitled to a regular procedural process. And there is another kind of due process right which is much more complex, I'm afraid, and it is called a substantive due process right. Life and liberty are substantive rights. They were not given to you by Congress. You were endowed by your Creator with certain rights. As Mr. Justice Douglas once said, a substantive right is one that existed before the Constitution. It's one that existed before the United States was formed. And in his words, it even existed before there was a school system. There. In other words, it is a right which does not arise because of some legislation someplace. It's the other way around. You as a human being have certain rights which cannot be taken away from you. Now we come back to those magic words again, without due process of law. Your life can be taken from you by the state, you know. Your liberty can be taken away from you. We do that all the time. We execute people, fortunately not very frequently. We deprive people of liberty hourly by the scads. And obviously, all of you have been deprived of property once in a while, unless you drive differently than I do, or have more luck than I do. It seems like once in a while I fork over at least $5 for having parked the parking meter too long or some other offense like that. I'm being deprived of my property, but I'm getting due process. Okay? That's due process. Now, the limitation, and I should say that the wording of the Fifth Amendment says that no person shall be deprived and so forth. It doesn't say anything about corporations or school systems or anything else. It's no person. Because, you see, our belief is that it only people were endowed with certain inalienable rights, which makes them human beings. So cows don't have constitutional protected right to liberty and life. It's okay to slaughter a cow, constitutionally at least. Boy Scouts as an organization don't, as individuals they do, and so forth. Okay? Now, the limitation of the Fifth Amendment was, because it was part of the original Bill of Rights, it applied only to enactments of the federal Congress. At the time the Constitution was adopted, the states were very, very suspicious about the federal government. And they didn't want the federal government telling the states how to run the business. The states' rights was a big thing at that time. Well, it didn't work out so well. As you all know, we had a Civil War, and one of the major problems of the Civil War, there were a large number of persons, happened to be black, who were being deprived of certainly their liberty, certainly their property, and not infrequently their lives. And the question was whether or not this was a violation of the Constitution. Well, it wasn't. In most instances, the deprivation was not occurring because of federal law. It was occurring because of state law. And there was nothing in the constitution of the state which said that they couldn't take away life, liberty, or property, at least not some of the state constitutions. And the federal government's limitations did not apply to legislation of a state. Huh? So at the end of the Civil War, we got the 14th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment says that no state shall enact legislation which deprives people of life, liberty, or property without due process, nor shall any person be denied equal protection of the laws. So now we've got the due process, substantive and procedural, and we've got a brand new thing called equal protection for state laws, that is. Equal protection already there for federal government, now for state laws too. Equal protection, now this is another category of rights, and then we'll get down to children. Equal protection means that when legislation of a state, 14th Amendment, federal government, earlier provisions of the Constitution, classifies people so that something happens to these folks, it doesn't happen to those folks, good or bad, that classification must be now we come to the big problem, rational, reasonable, necessary. Well, it depends upon what the criteria is for the classification. For example, if one were to say that all people who are black are treated this way and all people who are white are treated this way, that would be an invidious discrimination, suspect from the word go, and almost literally impossible of ever showing that it's a reasonable or necessary or proper basis for differentiating. What reasonable differentiation can be made upon the basis of color or one's ethnic background or, because of other provisions in the Constitution also, one's religion? We simply have decided that those are not proper differentiations. And so, unless there is a flat-out compelling need which just can't be met any other way, you cannot differentiate in legislation on the basis of a suspect category. Now, there are certain kinds of differentiating criteria which are not so strong. They are not so suspect. For example, age. Legislation may be made that people who are over the age of 65 can get Social Security and people who are under 65 will not. There, all you have to do is to show that the state has a valid interest, that the legislation that's been enacted is reasonable and to address that interest, and that it's not over necessarily sweeping or broad in depriving people of more rights than you have to in order to accomplish the state's legitimate purpose. All right? Are you now ready to receive a Bachelor of Laws as experts in constitutional law? Or do you want to cross-examine at this point? You've just had a 9-hour course. That means 90 class hours. So if there's a little bit of fuzz around the edges, why, it's understandable, although I can't understand how you wouldn't possibly understand now that I've explained it so clearly. All right, you get the basic idea. Due process with its two variations, substantive and procedural, and equal protection of the laws. Okay. Now let's talk about children. Almost always when a question arises as to the relationship between a parent and a child, somebody will say, well, after all, the family is absolutely fundamental in our society, and we ought to do everything that we can to protect the family. Oh, I think that's a pretty good argument. The only problem is that there's nothing in the Constitution that says that no family shall be deprived of anything. It says that no person shall be deprived of anything. And that's a big word, no person. The whole fight going on in Congress right now, it's been going on all over the United States, about whether or not abortion is constitutionally protectable or not, whether the child, the fetus has any rights. A fetus is not a person. A fetus is a fetus. Congress is about to ask you, perhaps, to adopt a constitutional amendment which will say that a fetus is a person. If a fetus is a person, bingo! You get constitutionally protectable rights all the way. So a family is not a person. However, could we make an argument that says that people have constitutionally protected rights to be a family? Or to be a parent, something of that nature. Well, let's see, that's not life. And a parent's interest in the child is probably not property. Although that's a little bit arguable. Do you feel like you own your children? Don't pass that by too quickly, you know. An awful lot of thought that says that parents, well, it comes awfully close, doesn't it, to owning the children. You know, you can even transfer title to them in adoption. It's kind of a repulsive thought. How about liberty? Can't be deprived of liberty. What is liberty? The United States Supreme Court, in a rather long series of cases, has been hammering out the definition of what is liberty. And one of the big things about liberty, one of the words that's been used to describe what it is, among other things, is a right to privacy. A right to make your own decisions. Look where we're coming. And so it's been said in a number of decisions that parents have the right to make decisions about children. That this is a constitutionally protected right wrapped up in the word privacy, decision making. And why is it a constitutionally protected right? Well, by golly, it was there before there was any legislation. Parents have been making decisions for children for a long time now. I don't know about your family, but I've got ancestors that go back an awfully long way. Maybe you do too. And most of those ancestors made decisions about their children. What the children would eat, where they would sleep, what kind of training they would be given, what kind of medical care they would be given. Yeah, that was going on before there was a Congress, before there was a Constitution, before there was a school system. And so it is frequently argued that one of the things inherent, fundamentally inherent, in being a parent is that you have a right to make decisions about your child. A little bit sounds like property again, but maybe it's a decision-making right. And the other side, the correlation to that, does a child have a duty to obey its parents? Yeah, we sure start an argument about that one awfully quickly. Suppose that we look at some specifics for just a moment, see whether or not any of the recent decisions can help us in trying to figure out how this goes. Has a parent the right to discipline a child? Reprove, spank, beat, break an arm if necessary, knock out a tooth here and there? Do you have any reactions to that? I'm trying to give you a sequence from Tut Tut Junior, don't do that. Or to, hey Ma, kicking down the stairs again. Or he walks the way he bounces. Any guidelines in there?
I think parents have the right to discipline children, but when it comes to injuring their child, that's when it becomes a child abuse.
Becomes a child abuse. Lovely terminology that you've said. What, may I cross-examine? What do you mean when you say child abuse?
Well, I think there's child abuse in the form of physical abuse, and there's child abuse in the form of emotional deprivation.
And when you say that there is child abuse, let's take a real bad case so that we won't argue about the facts, so that it meets any one of our definition of child abuse. And I'm sure that you've all heard about those cases, and if you haven't, you should. They're horrible, absolutely horrible things that parents sometimes do to children. Now watch me now, because I'm going to be tricky here. Does the child have a right against the parent with reference to child abuse? I remember, if you're going to talk about a right, you've always got to say there's a correlative duty. Let me rephrase my question right away so that you don't walk into a trap without thinking about it. If a child has a right against the parent has a duty, in order to be definable as a right, we have to say that the child can do something about it.
No, the state can do something about it.
The state has a right.
The state has a right to interfere in the family.
The state has a right to control parents who get out of line. After all, we can't beat people. We cannot, without reason, injure other people.
That's right.
And children
assault.
Are people. That's
and
right.
The state has to step in and file the assault charge against the parent.
That's right.
On behalf of the child.
Yeah, if one of us goes out and starts beating on somebody else, we may be committing a crime. You all know what that is. We may be committing a tort, personal injury. If it's a crime, the state can do something about it. If it's a tort, a private injury, if you hit somebody else purposefully, deliberately, and injure them, does that person have a cause of action against the one who did the hitting, the injured party?
How old is the injured party?
Oh, 26.
He can file with the state an assault charge against that person.
Assault charge? Yeah, I'm not. Assault is kind of a tort when it's done in private places. Assault, incidentally, technically means that you scare them. A battery is where you slug them. There, that's free. Here, you can have that. We're drawing a definition here, if you'll notice, between criminal activity, where the state is always the moving party, and a private action called tort. The one that we see most frequently is somebody who's negligent. For example, an automobile accident causes harm. And if they harm me, and they have been negligent, and I've been damaged by their negligence, I can sue them to be reimbursed for the harm that's been caused. Now let's go back to the child that's just been harmed by the parent. Does the child have a tort action against the parent? You understand tort now? Yeah. T-O-R-T. Put an E on the end, you got something to eat. But it's a good English word. Chaucer and all those fellows said, the lion shall lie down with the lamb, and neither the other shall tort. You got that out of Scripture.
There are some situations where children have sued their parents for civil things.
Successfully?
I don't know about successfully.
We had a case in the state of Washington a long time ago. A parent seduced his daughter, raped, if you will. Sexual assault and treatment is not at all uncommon, I'm sorry to say. Horribly mistreated this young girl, and she wanted to sue him for damages. You want to guess as to whether or not she was successful in her action?
She was
not. Why?
It's the parent.
It's against the parent, but why should that make a difference?
He has different rights than the non-parent.
Or she has no rights.
Or
he has a right to control, and she has a duty to submit.
Correct.
Even to conduct that we think is heinous, and so forth.
At least some people would define it as such.
Yes. The line in that one from the Supreme Court's opinion that always really gets me is that to do anything else would disrupt family harmony. Somehow or other, that leaves you with a little funny feeling in the pit of your stomach. Now, I'm happy to say that case is a very old one. And there have been cases since then, and I want you now to see a trend. Because up until about 6-7 years ago, there was a very rapidly developing trend which said that that children can sue parents for wrongful conduct and recover damages against the parent. You lay a hand on me, Dad, and I'll have you in court.
You say that was the trend?
Very rapid development of a line of cases which permitted children to recover in tort actions against their parents. Now, there are some gimmicks in there, such as the fact that the father or the mother, whoever was doing the activity, had insurance, and you could recover from the insurance company, or something of that sort. But the underlying thing was that there was a cause of action. Do you like that development?
No.
It's good enough to let the state be the guardian of the child's safety?
I don't think the state's got any business being the guardian of the children at all. Just to be a provocateur.
Yes. Well, you're more of a prophet. We seem to have crested out on this business of tort actions by children against parents. And now we are pulling back and saying, don't know this is such a good idea. And here comes a very strong thesis being made that says the state really can't take care of children. Every time the state's tried it, it's botched the job. Juvenile courts, bad news, really bad news. Foster parents, well, there have been a lot of wonderful people who've been foster parents, but there have been a lot of bad news foster cases. Institutions for children, where they're taken away and put in the institution. Bad news. People are saying that, you know, there's something about the family structure that's so important, so fundamental to the way that human beings live, that even though it sometimes doesn't work so well, it's better than your other choices. I don't know whether you believe that or not.
It still seems to be a little different, though. Foster care and institutionalizing children, it's more the care of children rather than the protection of children. You know, in terms of having somebody to speak for the child as a voice to offset the weight that parents carry within the family structure.
Don't misunderstand me now. I'm not saying the parents don't have duties. Parents have duties to care for their children, to feed their children, and so forth. But the right is not one which belongs to the child. It belongs to the state. If you don't pay support for your child, somebody from the state will be around to collect. Or if the child goes down to the grocer and buys necessary food to live, the grocer can sue you for the price of the groceries, but not the child. That's because it is thought that having legal action between parent and child is just not a very good idea. And there's some support for that, incidentally. We have in this state, many states have the same kind of thing, that if a child goes out and breaks somebody's plate glass window, does a couple $100 worth of damage, that recovery can be had against the parent. Pretty good idea, huh? I know of cases in which children have said, Dad, I want the car tonight. Dad said no. And the child then says, Dad, how'd you like to pay about $1,000 for a broken plate glass window? Dad says, well, try and get the car back early, will you? Now there you got a nice policy problem. And so far the response has been, we better not give the kids any more clubs than they've already got in the negotiating process with their parents. Because we want to try and preserve a certain order that we find in families, and that order basically is that the old folks tell the young folks what to do. Think about education for a moment. You probably have known people who said, I'm not wildly enthusiastic about the school system around here. My spouse, perhaps myself, lots of experience teaching children. We are educated persons ourselves. We have the time and the desire. We'll keep the kids home and we'll teach them ourselves. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. Truant officer will be after you.
Not in all states.
Not in all states.
Doing it in the state of Washington.
Not in all states. Some states have what's known as a tolerance policy. Mm-hmm. Brother, go and sin no more. Think about education for a moment. You probably have known people who said, I'm not wildly enthusiastic about the school system around here. My spouse, perhaps myself, lots of experience teaching children. We are educated persons ourselves. We have the time and the desire. We'll keep the kids home and we'll teach them ourselves. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. Truant officer will be after you.
Not in all states.
Not in all states.
Doing it in the state of Washington.
Not in all states. Some states have what's known as a tolerance policy. Mm-hmm. Brother, go and sin no more. We have education laws. They're mandatory education laws. Schools, the kind of education, how many hours, what you study, can be prescribed by the statute. Do parents have a right to say, I don't want my child educated that way?
Yes.
Constitutional?
Constitutional, I would say.
Certainly not legislative.
No.
Are the mandatory school attendance laws unconstitutional?
I believe so.
And that's a very nice question. Of course, it's been litigated a good many times. Basically, it's been found that you may be told by the state that your child will show up in this building at this hour for this period of time, for this many years, and will be educated by these people on these subjects. And if you keep the child home, you could be dealt with either criminally or by fines or some other way.
Where does the state take that right from?
Where is that right from? What gives the state the right to decide how my child is going to be educated? I'm paraphrasing your question, obviously. Isn't there some kind of a fundamental right that goes back before the Constitution, the school system, all the rest of that stuff, that says that parents get to decide what their kids are going to be like? Well, you remember a few moments ago, I'm sure you remember when we were talking about that a few moments ago, that you cannot be deprived of these substantial rights unless there is a compelling reason. And then you may be deprived if you are deprived in a due process way. But there has to be a compelling reason. Is there any compelling reason why children ought to be educated according to curriculum and teachers and ages and so forth as prescribed by the government?
I personally think it's immoral to let them.
Historically, a lot of children were not allowed to have an education.
Some children were not, and then the states felt it was necessary to see to it they got an education. That's all a little different edge, isn't it? Here is a family that says we'll educate our own kids. And the state says, yeah, we don't want them educated that way. We've had lots of good cases. We Lutherans have produced a fair number of them. For example, there's a case that got the United States Supreme Court in Nebraska, Myers against the state of Nebraska. Arose at the time of the First World War, when it was suddenly discovered that it was immoral and indecent and illegal and probably fattening to teach children German. And so the law was enacted that children might not be taught German in the schools. You don't want to corrupt their morals. Well, Myers is a fellow who ran parochial school, good old German congregation, and after all, you know, you can't really confirm a child unless the child knows how to speak German. I went to Saturday school so I could learn how to talk enough German so that I could be confirmed. Otherwise, I guess I wouldn't have been confirmed for a long time. God spoke German for those of you who don't know. So the Myers people in Nebraska said, we have a constitutional right to teach German to our children. Yes? No?
Sure.
Yeah? Yeah. So also in Oregon with a Catholic school. And then came a woman who was a Jehovah's Witness person, and she said that I'm entitled to teach this child a lot of things, and it's a religious and an educational process, and one of the things is that she ought to learn how to sell pamphlets like the Watchtower and some other things on the streets in the evening with me. She's going to be with me. She's going to be protected. This is part of our religious conviction. And the state of Massachusetts said that's a violation of the child labor laws. Does the parent get to decide? You know, after all, this child could be seriously hurt being out there in the evening at 8 o'clock selling pamphlets with her relatives. Or don't you think so? That's corrupting the child. Morally, the child will never be the same again. Next thing you know, it might grow up to be a Jehovah's Witness.
Or a salesman.
Or a salesperson. Is it constitutional to deprive this woman of her right to have the child out on the street with her? The child was a youngster, 8 or 9 years of age. 8 o'clock in the evening? Or is that something that a child that the parents get to decide?
Court probably said it was unconstitutional.
It was unconstitutional. Now why? And if you can teach them German, I think you'd be able to help have them know how to sell pamphlets, wouldn't you? The Watchtower. I've never read very many Watchtowers. It's no worse than German, I assure you. What's the difference? The difference is the fact that there was a growing feeling that the state has more rights, should be more sensitive to the needs of children because children are getting beaten up, they're being abused. There ought to be a right to intervene. And parents' rights begin to dwindle. Parental right begins to dwindle. Now, does the child's right begin to inflate on the other side? And the question which we've got to think about now is, can the child start saying, well, I don't think I want to do what you suggested, Dad. You told me to eat my spinach, and I'm not going to. Or you suggested a certain kind of education, and I don't want to engage in that education. Or some other limitation that the child might want to impose. Push came to shove in a case called Wisconsin against Yoder, the Amish community. They did not want their children going beyond the first eighth grades. They didn't mind having their children go to public schools for the first 8 grades. It was high school that was really bugging them. Because they said, for our lifestyle, a simple style, out on the farm, horse and buggy, and a lot of other things, our children are better off letting us educate them after the 8th grade for our way of living. And the state of Wisconsin said, oh no. Fundamental interest of the state here. People have to be educated. They have to know about automobiles. And they have to know about lots of other things that you're not going to teach them about. Simplicity is all right for you folks, but not for your children, because this society has to have its young people being educated. So we got a nice sharp case here now. The state's saying that this is a fundamental interest. What do you think? Can Wisconsin compel an Amish child to go to high school? Is that like selling pamphlets from Jehovah's Witnesses on the streets? Or is that more like something else? Is Wisconsin's law constitutional or unconstitutional? Constitutional. I'm sorry, unconstitutional. The state may not force Amish parents to send their children beyond the eighth grade. Mr. Justice Douglas said, I'll go with you on this one, because the child doesn't want to go beyond the eighth grade. Bring me a child that wants to go to the eighth grade, and then I will say that there is a person there. A child is a person. And that person, eighth grader, now ready for high school, that person is a, here's a lovely term, I like it, a mature minor. Huh. Now, old enough to begin making decisions for herself or himself.
Did that become law, though, when he said that? That's just his opinion. Right?
That's his dissenting opinion.
Yeah.
His dissenting opinion. That was not the case, you see, before the court, because in the case before the court, the child didn't want to go to the eighth grade. They agreed with their parents. But Douglas says, you get me a child in here that wants to go to the eighth grade, and the parents say no. So we got a person in conflict with a person. And then I will tell you that the Constitution protects little and young people as well as older and big people.
Of course, that thought destroys all rights of the parents, or a lot of the rights of the parents, anyway.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
It's a woman by the name of Sumi, S-U-M-E-Y, who, 16 years old, had one child, pregnant with another child, addicted to the use of drugs, alcoholic, got a lot of problems. She says, my problems are the fact that my family and I have not gotten along for years. My dad and my mother are impossible. They drive me literally to behavior which they say they don't want and which I don't want. A Sumi girl showed up one day of her own volition in the juvenile court in Seattle and said, protect me. My parents are abusing me. And they called the parents and said, your daughter is down here and she wants to be living someplace other than at home. The parents said, good. We haven't been able to get along with her for a long time. Things are not going well at all. And if she wants to live someplace else and if you want to provide facility for her to live and take care of her, fine. That's great with us. So the state gave her what in the state of Washington is known as an ARP. ARP, Alternative Residential Placement. Everything's got to have a short handle on it. They put her in an ARP. At the end of the first month, they sent the parents a bill for her care. And the parents said, what are you trying to do? Interfere with our constitutional right to take care of our own child? You get her home right now. And the state said, but you said and she said that home was not a good place for her to live and she was being abused. And you agreed that she'd be placed someplace else. And they said, well, that's what we said. Now you send her home. Because we have a constitutional right to take care of our own daughter at home. The Sumi girl said, the law of the state of Washington, Juvenile Court Act, says that if there is a family in conflict where the child and the parents are no longer able to function minimally well anymore, that the child may demand an ARP, Alternative Residential Placement. And I claim the right which the statute gives me. And the parents said, that statute's unconstitutional because it gets in the way of the parents' right to provide for the child. We have not beaten our child. We have not knocked her teeth out. We've not broken her arms. Now, we haven't done a red-hot job of taking care of her, perhaps, because the product is not all that we want, but that's her fault. You know, the wild strain out there someplace. We're not responsible for that. And we want our child home. We are not unfit parents. We're good folks. And nobody could show that they were unfit. I mean, they weren't beasts of some sort or something of that sort. So the parents, they send her home. Assuming girl says, I want an ARP. It's a statute. Parents say the statute is unconstitutional, violation of either due process or equal protection. Other parents don't have their children going away, equal protection. And we've been deprived of liberty, privacy, the right to care for our own children. State Supreme Court asked me to write what's known as an amicus brief, amicus curiae, friend of the court,
court says, hooey, this is tough. You know, it's tough. And the arguments that we've been given on the two sides seems to us don't quite meet all of the points that might be discussed. And would you mind submitting a brief as friend of the court? Not arguing for the parents, not arguing for the girl, but just telling the court what's good policy, what's good law. Write an amicus brief for me. What will your argument be to the court? You see the policy point, I take it. I was amazed in writing United Airlines a little while after that to pick up a United, what do they call their magazine? Whatever.
Mainliner,
yeah. And, well, there was an article about the state of Washington. Lovely, what does it say? It says that Washington is the only state in the United States where parents can divorce, where children can divorce their parents. And I read, in what case was it? It was in Re Sumi. Parents cannot, under the statute, demand that their children be sent home if the children want to be in an alternative residential placement. Now, there's a lot more to it. The state's going to send social workers out to work with the parents and with the child, going to try and form a reconciliation. Every 6 months, they review the case. The whole objective is to get the family, which has been in conflict, working efficiently again. The parents in the Sumi case said, no dice. We want our home now. Don't you ever send us another bill. Which, of course, was a factor in this. But they were claiming a constitutional right. And so now you're going to write a brief, an amicus brief. You're going to tell the court what's good, solid policy here.
How do you do that for every... Of course, the problem, naturally, is what would apply to the Sumi girl and their parents can quite often be abused in other situations. And of course, that's always the problem.
We've got some factual problems, and we'll work out the factual problems as well as we can. Now, we simply will get the best evidence we can get, then we'll decide what the facts were. And then, after we know what our facts are, or after we've made that decision, we have to go over and look at our rule. And the rule here is that if you find these facts, and those facts were found, which would make this statute applicable, then the rule is that she might demand an ARP, separate residential, alternative residential placement. The parents say, can't disprove the facts. It's true what you say, that it meets the facts of the statute. However, the statute itself is unconstitutional. It's a violation of due process. So the issue before the court on appeal is the constitutionality of that statute. Do you understand?
Yeah.
Okay. Write the brief for me. What's your thinking about whether or not it's a good thing to have an ARP available? 16-year-old girl, you know her history. I've given it to you. It's a horrible history. I mean, it's a very unsettling kind of a history.
I guess where I see the problem is if this is pretty legal or whatever, if my 16-year-old gets angry and chooses an ARP, and the case is not the same,
yeah,
then it's going to be still going to be legal. And so this
if she just gets angry.
That case, I have no problems with her choosing an ARP.
Yeah.
But for one bad, you can have...
So we go spinning off on the how far does this go kind of argument.
It's probably going to be an unconstitutional law.
Of course, that's always true, isn't it? There aren't any sharp lines. There are only continuums. Anything that you want to think about, what's negligence? Well,
what
it goes all the way from a little to big. What's cruelty, little to big? What's irresponsible parenting, little to big?
What would constitute due process then? Would you have to have a trial? I mean, because I understand...
Procedural due process is easy. The parents get notified, they get to appear, they get to make arguments, they get to produce evidence, all the rest of those things, and have a trial. Substantive due process is the one that really breaks your neck. That is there inherent just in the fact of parenthood, the right to take care of the children, which is with the parents and is protected unless there is absolutely crashing, compelling right, and you know the whole society will crumble virtually unless such a statute is enacted. Compelling necessity. That's the substantive due process argument. Yes, ma'am.
Perhaps if the state is so willing to make these judgments, they should be willing to fork out the money to take care of their wards.
Perhaps. That's a question of legislative policy, not constitutionality. And maybe we all ought to march on the legislature and say, if you ever do that again, don't send the bill to the Sumis, send it to us. Taxpayers.
The fact that the Sumis agreed for alternative placement.
They did.
I think makes a financial responsibility there.
And they're willing to pay last month's bill. Now they say send her home and don't ever do that again. Because now we don't agree anymore. We've thought it over. She's better off at home than she is there. And the Sumis are not being that crass about it. They say, look, the amount of money you're asking for, there are three other kids at home. And we just can't afford it. The other kids will be really seriously deprived. And then they said a lot of other things, too.
Seems to me
the law in the state of, excuse me.
It seems to me that I don't understand how a state can usurp at any, you know, at a certain age, a child then is no longer a child. I don't know what that age is. But
very
certainly my goal as a parent is to make my children able to walk out the door in good faith and love at a certain point in their life. Maybe earlier than 18, maybe later than 18, in my particular family, and as each child develops in their own style. But how a state can constitutionally deprive me, the parent, and the child, the right of growing through life, as ordained by history since number one.
I'm glad you're thinking of those issues. We're going to have to go to the evening service now, but just let me lay a couple on you before you go. The child has gangrene. Death is inevitable in a couple of weeks, unless there's medical care. And the parents say, we'll pray about it. A child is born, unless there's a blood transfusion, the child will die. The parents say, we will not permit a transfusion. And so down through a line of horribles. And the parent is not acting as the parent sees it, irrationally. You know what cases? The parents have two children. One needs an organ transplant, say a kidney. The other child is healthy, has two kidneys. They say to the other child, do you want to share your kidney with your sibling who needs one? The child says, no, I don't. And parents then say, we hereby order you to give one of your kidneys to the other child. Parents get to make those kind of decisions.
Is that not what the role of the parent is, though?
That's what we're asking.
The state can't take unfair advantage of the parent, though. I mean, it seems to me that if the state comes in a case like this, they've got to make sure that the parent is equally able to respond to the situation. I think that can happen.
Parents say the child is acting irrationally. The child is insane, doesn't believe what I believe. Therefore, we're going to place it as an insane person in a state institution. The state says, have you talked to a psychiatrist? We don't believe in psychiatrists. Anybody else think the child is insane? We don't ask anybody else. It's our child and we make the decisions. The child is going into the institution. Parm against J.R. about 1 year ago in the United States Supreme Court. Do the parents get to make that decision? Well, there are an unbelievable number of these cases which have to be assessed. The little girl in Washington, elephantiasis in one arm. The weight of her arm exceeded the weight of the rest of her body. Death is inevitable. And the parents are asked to permit the child to have the arm amputated to save her life, and the answer is no. Happened to be Lutherans. Can the amputation be ordered, notwithstanding the refusal of the parents to consent? The trial court said no. The parents have the right to make that decision. Supreme Court reversed and said, yes, too late, the child died anyway. These are the questions that one has to wrestle with when you get to the tension between parent and child. Or over time, you can think about it, sleep well.